When it comes to belief in magic, the paranormal, the supernatural, the occult, no one knows more about it maybe than Stephen King, the fabulously successful writer, author. How many bestsellers has he had? How many millions of books has he written? It's an interesting perspective in this book by Jeff Kripal, authors of The Impossible, how Stephen King sort of taps into the unknown and how it comes spilling out on these pages. We'll get into that and then into a conversation about the father of everything weird, Charles Fort, when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff Kripal's latest book, Authors of the Impossible, is what we're discussing tonight. And Jeff, right toward the beginning of the book, in the section about Myers, you mentioned Stephen King. And it's as if Stephen King is tapping into something as a way to crank out all these blockbusters.
Right. Well, I'm just taking King at his word. He wrote a little book in 2000 called On Writing, a memoir of the craft, and he talks about, or he writes in that book about how finding a story to tell is for him like uncovering a dinosaur bone in the ground. In other words, it's already there, and what the creative artist does is uncover something, or as Myers would say, remember something that pre-exists the particular artist or author. And King also had this wonderful, I think quite beautiful notion of writing as telepathy. In other words, as a writer, he could write down in 2010 his own state of mind exactly as it is, and 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the line, some complete stranger can pick up that book and recreate his state of mind in almost perfect faithfulness. And so King was basically saying there's something occult about writing and reading. And this really is the central claim of my book, is that the paranormal is fundamentally about reading and writing. But that doesn't mean, that's not to reduce it to something banal and simple, is to say that reading and writing themselves can also be occult. They can take on paranormal dimension, and they do, of course, all the time.
You know, you hear songwriters, popular songwriters, most successful songwriters of our age, who will say things like, "Well, the melody just popped into my head," or "The
Right.
whole song was, I wrote it in 5 minutes. It just came into my head." It really is like they are tapping into something, if not a memory, then maybe some gigantic stream of information floating around in the ether somewhere that then some people can tap into it better than the rest of us.
Right. I think if you talk to any practicing artist who is experienced and serious about his or her craft, you will at some point hear them say something like, "Well, it was as if it came out of nowhere," or "It was as if I was channeling this." And I know as a writer myself that your best moments, your best hours are those in which you've forgotten yourself and you're simply tapping away and you have no idea where this stuff is coming from. Although, of course, it is based on what you've read and what you've experienced, but the way it comes out is very spontaneous, and then you can appreciate this sense of, coming from out of nowhere.
Moving on to out of nowhere, Charles Fort. I mean, this guy, everybody who listened to this program would know his name because
Right.
he's legendary in the field. But I learned so much about him in this chapter of yours. The first one, the biggest surprise is the sense of humor that he had. How,
Yeah.
because he, he took it seriously, but he had fun with it. And the second thing was how hard he worked at it. You start off by describing how he would dig up some of these cases and instances. Tell me about that.
Well, again, I mean, this is the surprise, I think, both for me. Well, there's a lot of surprises for me here too. One is that after studying religion professionally for 25 years, I had never heard of this guy. And what happened was a dear friend and good colleague of mine named David Hufford, who studies, by the way, supernatural occult traditions, read something I wrote years ago and said, "Well, Jeff, you sound a lot like Charles Fort." And I said, "Who the hell is Charles Fort?" And so I went and looked this guy up and read his books, and I was just stunned. I was stunned by how smart he was, what a great writer he was, and how funny he was, and but also how serious a researcher he was. Basically, what he did is he went to the New York Public Library for decades, every afternoon, and read every single newspaper or journal in French or German back to 1800. I mean, and then what he would do is he would isolate these, what he called damned facts, and he would write them on little slips of paper, and he would then classify them. He had hundreds and thousands of shoe boxes in his apartment, and he had them all marked with numbers and letters, and he would take these little slips of paper and he would put them in the right shoe box depending on what the story was. And after he did this for decades, he then compared those, put them into a book form, and he started publishing his books.
And was he successful financially, in a popular sense, off the bat?
No, not at all. The only reason he was published is because he had a fan named Theodore Dreiser, who was a very successful novelist and very well-known American literateur, and Dreiser basically threatened his own publisher that if he didn't publish Ford, he was going to take his books elsewhere. And so his first book came out in 1919 called The Book of the Damned. It's probably his best, certainly his most famous. But he met with no literary success in his life. He and his wife, Anna, managed to live a very simple life, mostly in the New York area, because literally a rich uncle died and left him an inheritance. But before that, Anna and Charles lived in abject poverty. I mean, at one point, Charles was breaking up the furniture to put in the fire to keep him warm.
Seems to me that the thing that jumps out at you for people that needed something to jog their memory about Charles Fort is the writing about things coming out of the sky, fish and frogs and strange raining of different
right.
creatures and things of that sort. He had a pile of those, didn't he?
Right. He was obsessed with fish falling out of the sky, which is really funny if you think about it.
And does that qualify as a supernatural or paranormal, or are there pretty good explanations for that stuff?
Well, gosh, I don't know. For him, it wasn't just the fish falling out of the sky. It was all sorts of stuff falling out of the sky. And, you know, Ford had some wonderful ideas, some profound thoughts, but he also had some just crazy ideas. And one of his crazy ideas was that there was land just a few hundred miles up there. So, I mean, he wasn't always right by any means, but he had a knack for latching on to these crazy events that would appear in the newspapers and then showing how the religious authorities and the scientific authorities would ignore them or dismiss them or, as he said, damn them. That was his technical phrase.
And he would, of course, was interested in, you know, applying some of these wild stories to evolution, mixing the two together into it. And this, I know this sort of fits into one of your interests, and that's in like X-Men and superheroes. And I guess we could say that Fort is sort of the father of super whatever, supernatural, super.
That's right.
He used that word a lot. Or that.
That's right. There's one paragraph in that chapter where I just collect all of his supers, and there must be 30 or 40 or 50 of them. He loved the adjective super, and he definitely believed that these paranormal powers were gifted to us by evolution, and that we've lost a lot of them because we don't have particular need of them now, but that they could come back if we need them again. And he did not believe, however, that evolution was random. He was not a Darwinian. He believed that evolution had a mind of its own, as it were, and that there was an intelligence woven into nature, and particularly evolution.
Super bat, super biology, super dragon, super evil, super Hibernia,
yeah.
Super Niagaras, a super ocean, super magnets. There's the
I
list goes
there's
on.
There's also
and on.
Super whiskey and super Bibles, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Sounds like he could write for the Weekly World News or something.
Charles, I'd have him write for anything. You know, he made his living before he wrote these these four weird books, he made his living as a humorist, writing for magazines and newspapers. So that really comes out, actually.
I mentioned about the X-Men, and you've written about that sort of, I don't think it's in this book, but I remember seeing it something online that you had had an interest in evolution and the possibility that maybe humans evolve into something like the X-Men with superpowers. That sort of fits into the Freudian world, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It also fits into Myers, because remember, Myers believed that evolution was what was creating these powers. He called them supernormal, by the way. Myers believed that we were evolving from the normal to the supernormal. So there's that word super again. And I am. I'm currently writing a book on the paranormal in popular culture. And one of the themes I'm looking at is what I call the myth theme of mutation, which is this essentially this X-Men notion. The X-Men are simply one example of it. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of examples that go all the way back to the 1860s. But Myers and Ford are two of the earliest, and I think two of the most sophisticated.
One of the central themes that he developed and that you write about is this three eras or dominance.
Right.
The three dominants. What is that?
Well, this is where I think Ford gets really, really sophisticated. And then this is where I think he's maybe underappreciated by his fans. He believed, and this is where he begins to sound a lot like frankly, a historian or a philosopher. These three dominants were, he believed that in different eras, there's a different dominant. And every dominant has to damn whatever doesn't fit into it. So essentially, every era, there's some kind of cultural system that claims to be the truth of things. And whatever it can't explain or doesn't fit in, it damns by, you know, ignoring it or sometimes actually persecuting it or censoring it or whatever it was. And for Fort, we've moved through two of those, and we're looking towards a third. The first one was religion. And in the era of religion, the dominant way of knowing was belief, and the people who controlled that dominant were the priests and the religious authorities. We've moved out of that, essentially, and now we're in the dominant of science. And the way of knowing is one of explanation, and the new priests are called scientists. And what he thought we would eventually move into was what he called intermediatism, not a happy word, but a precise one, and that the way of knowing in this new era of the future is what he called expression, and that the specialists were essentially the wizards and witches of the future. So those were his three dominants. I think what's so powerful about that is it essentially argues that what we think we know is really relative to our particular era and our time and place, and that it will be replaced by a different system.
He was still in his teens when he starts writing about what we would call UFOs. And he finds, I guess he must have found bits and pieces of information here and there. I know he wrote about that great wave of 1897. This guy could, in some ways, be called the father of ufology, I guess.
Oh, I think he was. I think without a doubt he was. He didn't call them UFOs, of course. He called them super constructions in the sky. And his books are filled with this stuff. And some of it's quite eerie, actually, in which he quotes newspaper accounts really around the world, particularly from the States, though, of these, you know, huge triangular or rectangular, whatever shape they were, just floating over the city and beaming down with searchlights, all kinds of stuff. He did believe. I mean, he said he was clever in his books, but I think he really did believe that these were essentially spaceships and that we were being visited by he didn't call them aliens. But that's essentially what they were in his.
Yeah, there's a quote in there that you have of his. He goes that the notion that other worlds are attempting to communicate with this world is widespread. My own notion is that it's not an attempt at all, that it was an achievement centuries ago.
Right. There's some lovely passages. Maybe I have the book here as well. We can find that passage about the eerie way he writes about this. You know, these huge bats or vampires in the sky.
Angels?
Angels, too. Yeah, he invokes all of this.
Did he believe that this is all sort of some, and do you suspect that it's all somehow connected? And I ask the question in this context. Myself and a couple of friends had written about a place called the Skinwalker Ranch, the Bigelow Ranch in Utah, which is unique in the sense that it manifests all of the stuff that you would consider paranormal, supernatural. I mean, UFO sightings, poltergeist activity, Bigfoot, cattle mutilations, crop
It's
circles,
all there, huh?
all in one place, telepathic events, all in one place, almost as if it is saying they're all related. And I wonder, have you thought about whether it's all related, whether the Fortean stuff is somehow all related, all in the same other world, or it's telling us that there are many worlds that can intrude on ours?
My own gut feeling about this, George, is that it is all related. And that it all has something to do with the nature of consciousness or mind. I'd love to read that book, by the way. What's the title?
Hunt for the Skinwalker. I'll send you one.
Yeah, please do. I'd love to read it. What that reminds me of is another author whom I'm sure you've talked about on this program, named John Keel.
Sure.
And Keel was so interesting. Of course, he himself was a Fortean. But what he was so good at was showing that things that we would normally think of as not related actually are. So he would dig up all of these cases of UFO encounters, for example, in which some kind of Sasquatch or Bigfoot also was on the scene.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, that makes the damned doubly damned, right? It makes it even more difficult to talk about because now you just don't have a seeming spaceship. You have a big hairy monster to deal with as well. But I suspect on some level that all of those things are related. And how Keel related, he related them to this notion of the super spectrum that he developed. But my own gut feeling is that's he's onto something there, and that Fort was onto something. Fort felt that they were all related for sure.
Well, you get a situation where, and there are a lot of cases where Bigfoot is associated, or Bigfoot-like creatures are associated with UFO sightings, and and it gets to a point where it is so ridiculous
Yeah,
that it's that it
right.
almost seems to be challenging our credulity
Sure.
on purpose and laughing at us. And if you were to throw Elvis in on the spaceship, that would make it, you know what I mean? Like it's purposely mocking us or pushing the boundary and forcing us to think in a different way.
Two of my authors of the impossible, Jacques Vallée and Bertrand Meust, both emphasize this quality. They call it the absurd. And they both posit that the absurd is intentional and that it's part of the message. And so I think that's essentially what you're saying too.
Let's move to valet. We're going to have to take a break in about 2 minutes. But how is it that you come across Jacques' works, and was it sort of like with Fort that you suddenly see this guy and will go, "Whoa, where has this been all this time?"
Yeah, that's exactly what it was like. Well, do you want me to start or you want to take a
Sure.
break?
Yeah, we got a minute or so.
No, what happened there was, I was working on another book called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, which is about the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. And this is an incredibly rich history of how the human potential movement was born in the 60s and into the 70s and 80s. And part of that history involved remote viewing and UFOs. And that's a complex story there. But as I was doing back research for the Esalen book, I, of course, ran into Jacques' books. And I immediately recognized them as Jacques was basically doing history of religion, which is what I was trained to do. And he was relating UFO encounters to mysticism and to the occult and to folklore and to all of these things I was trained to study myself. And not only was he doing that, he was doing that in a beautiful way. Jacques is a gorgeous writer, as I'm sure you know. And
Oh, yeah.
I was just enchanted by his books, but also by his insistence that the sciences were not up to explaining this, that they needed the humanities and they needed philosophy and they needed the history of mysticism to make sense of this data.
Yeah, I think that is his lasting contribution, his most important one. We'll get into Jacques Vallée and Passport to Magonia, Messengers of Deception, and other matters in our discussion with Jeff Kripal, authors of The Impossible. We're talking with Jeff Kripal about Authors of the Impossible and one of the best known in the world, Jacques Vallée, who not only is known for writing about UFOs, but in a larger sense, something called forbidden science. And when we come back, we'll explain what that is here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff Kripal is my guest. We're talking about Jacques Vallée, one of his authors of The Impossible. It seems, Jeff, that every book that Jacques has written in the UFO field anyway has advanced the field immensely. You know, Anatomy of a Phenomenon, I remember reading that a long time ago. And Jacques, unlike just the people who advanced the ancient astronaut theory, I mean, he really looked into this stuff and is the first academic to look at, for example, those reliefs of things that look very much like UFOs over Nuremberg and Switzerland in the 1500s. Am I correct?
Right. Well, actually, Carl Jung had discussed those wood blocks before Jacques, but actually, Jung, I think, in some ways, is a kind of proto Jacques Vallée in some of this, in the way he wrote about UFOs in 1958. But Jacques just added. I mean, Jacques took that discussion to an entirely different level. I think that's very clear.
He makes a comparison between some of those broadsheets to Fatima. And I know there's an ongoing interest in Fatima among our listeners, but you also have an interest in that as well. And you mention it, sort of draw a conclusion about Fatima in your book. I don't want to get too far away from Jacques, but since he mentions it as well, tell me what you think about Fatima.
Well, I grew up with Fatima, as it were, as a very pious Catholic boy. In Nebraska, I remember praying to the Our Lady of Fatima through my childhood, actually. And so I grew up with the traditional framing of those events, and I remember reading all of the pious literature around it, Miracle of the Sun and all this. When I was researching this book, of course, I ran into Fatima everywhere among the ufologists. They're attracted to it, like bees or, bears to honey or whatever metaphor you want to work, along with the Ezekiel vision. Those are probably the two major Western religious experiences that they are most attracted to. But the Fatima stuff was incredibly detailed, and because it occurred in the 20th century, the documentation is there. And I was frankly blown away by it, particularly how well it fits ufological reading with the falling leaf pattern and the silver disc in the sky and the different ways different people perceived that event in 1917.
I know that Jacques has not always been a popular figure in mainstream ufology, even though, an outsider might think, how is that possible? Because he has always challenged the paradigms of the day. Ufology, as you probably know, in the beginning, they were comfortable with the idea of flying saucers, but were uncomfortable with the idea that there were people inside. And then they were uncomfortable with the idea of people inside that interacted with us or abducted people like us. The abductee stories or contactee stories. And Jacques has challenged many of those paradigms, suggesting, for example, that they are not extraterrestrials or not from another planet. I remember him telling me in an interview how disappointed he would be if the answer to the UFO mystery was something as simple as people visiting from other planets. He had a much more elaborate, much more mystical and beautiful sort of an explanation that if they could bend space and time, they could basically be from anywhere.
Right. Well, this is what John Keel thought as well. Keel wrote about ultra-terrestrials. He didn't think they were from outer space either. And Jacques and Keel were roughly contemporaries, writing in the 60s and 70s. Although my reading of Jacques is that he begins with a kind of traditional hardware approach, right? Anatomy of a Phenomenon and A Challenge to Science, which appear in 65 and 66, are pretty much in that traditional, you can go up and kick the tires approach that was floating around and that was part of Project Blue Book and that whole thing. He doesn't really break with that until 69 when Passport to Magonia comes out, and that's a real break. That's the book in which he really begins to, essentially take on a new, completely new voice and starts to relate flying saucers to folklore and to, things like fairies and angels and demons and mysticism, this sort of thing.
Essentially saying that the things that they were seeing back then as fairies or leprechauns or goblins are pretty darn close to what we are seeing now as aliens and extraterrestrials.
Right, and even more radically than that, that doesn't mean that the leprechauns and the fairies and the goblins were really aliens. What it means is that we see aliens because of science fiction that we're embedded in, and they saw angels and demons because of the Catholicism they were embedded in. But none of us are probably right that there is something appearing to us, but that it's being filtered through our perceptual ability.
Well, I wonder, I guess we can't answer this question, but I wonder how it, whether it's a result of our filters or because the whatever is creating these manifestations is appealing to the current gestalt kind of a
Right.
thing, you know, that
Yeah.
they're tailoring their message to fit the times or whether.
That would even be weirder, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, who knows?
No, who does know? I certainly don't. I guess what I'm so why I was so attracted to Jacques' approach, though, is that he was as hard on the professional skeptics as he was hard on the true believers, and he insisted that, and he still insists, I think, that the true believers are wrong because they mistake their perceptions for the stimulus that's really out there. And the skeptics are wrong because they deny that there's a stimulus out there. I think what I hear Jacques saying is that there really is a stimulus out there. It really has a physical component, but it's almost certainly not what we perceive it to be or think it to be. It's something else.
Of course, the then he got unpopular all over again with the information in Messengers of Deception, where he basically says the government is using this. They're leading us around by the nose for their own nefarious purposes, and we've been duped. And boy, a lot of people in the field didn't like that.
Right. And again, I mean, boy, the UFO thing, it seems to me, is a whole lot of things that we lump together. And that's what I heard Jacques saying there too, is that, some of this stuff probably is secret military hardware flying around in our skies. Some of it probably is staged and fraudulent, and some of it is almost certainly real, and it all gets lumped together, and that's why it's so darn confusing.
We've been surprised to learn in the last couple of years that Jacques has not only have been a student and writing about the technique known as remote viewing, but he actually does it. He's engaged in it himself. What do you make of remote viewing and how it fits into the big picture?
Well, I wrote a couple chapters on remote viewing in my History of Esalen. I've interviewed a lot of the figures who ran the remote viewing programs at SRI and later elsewhere. And my sense of it is that they had a few very, very gifted remote viewers that in an earlier age would have been called clairvoyants, and that something very real was happening there, but that it was so subversive to contemporary science, and it was also so subversive to the conservative religious beliefs of a lot of the military leaders that it just, it eventually was shut down. I think both for rational scientific reasons, but also primarily, I think, sometimes for religious reasons. That's something we haven't talked about this evening, is how problematic paranormal powers are for religious authorities and religious communities.
Well, why would that be a threat?
Well,
Explain it.
it's very simple. Religion, this is where, I think I can speak with some authority, and I think I actually do know something. Basically, religious traditions claim a great deal of authority for themselves and their scriptural texts and their religious leaders. and that they claim to mediate the sacred. In other words, they're in charge, they're in between the human being and the sacred, however the sacred's conceived. But what the paranormal suggests is that you don't need a mediator, you don't need a church, you don't need a scripture. You can have direct contact with the other world or with the dead or with even the divine yourself. And this is extremely threatening to religious traditions across the board.
So it's a matter of job security, turf?
Well, it's not just job security and turf. It's really a deep philosophical and doctrinal difference. I mean, if a female medium in the 19th century can sit down in her home and contact the dead, you really don't need the Bible or the church to do that. And that's a problem. That's a problem for lots of people. And this is why, historically, paranormally gifted men and women throughout Western history have not always been well received.
Or why witches were burned?
Yeah, well, that's part of it. You know, that actually does go back to the Hebrew scriptures, actually, where those sorts of things were roundly condemned. So I think in the contemporary period, you know, with remote viewing, for example, I mean, it was resisted both on scientific grounds but also on religious grounds. But I'm completely convinced, talking to the folks that I talked to and the material I read, that it was very successful at different points in time. Not always, of course. And that's the other problem. It's not 100% reliable by any stretch of the imagination.
And in the reticence of religions to embrace some of these things, how much of that is related to the possibility that superpowers or mind-reading abilities, telepathy, contact with other beings might be demonic?
Well, yeah, and again, this is why I'm so fascinated by the UFO material, is because if you read enough of that literature, it does break down into two camps. And one of those camps sees the alien as essentially an angel, a teacher of spiritual wisdom. And the other camp sees the alien as essentially a demon, somebody abducting or raping or scaring the shit out of us. So essentially what you have with the alien abduction literature is a recreation of the angel and the demon, right, in our modern world. And I think both of those, George, I would say, I wouldn't dismiss either of those experiences. And this is why the subtitle to my book is The Paranormal and the Sacred. Because the sacred in the study of religion does not mean the good. The sacred is this incredibly powerful energy or force that human beings have encountered for millennia, and it's both alluring and gorgeous and attractive, but it's also scary and sinister and dangerous. So the sacred is, it can go either way. It can be profoundly positive or profoundly negative. And I think that the paranormal sort of reinvokes the sacred in a kind of science fiction language.
Maybe it's a good subject for a chapter in a future book of yours, because there's a certain religious fervor in the UFO field right now about disclosure, the disclosure movement. We've got to have disclosure. It's coming around the bend any day now. And the debate has long focused on what the possible consequences would be. One reason for cover-ups, suspected cover-up, being that, well, people would freak out, in particular religions would freak out if there's some other presence, some other intelligence were confirmed by the government. And I remember starting out when I was first writing about this stuff, going around and interviewing leaders of different religious faiths, Baptists and Mormons and Catholics, and asking them, well, what about it? Would you guys freak out if suddenly it was confirmed that there's some other intelligence that's been visiting us? And all of them had the same reaction. They all basically said no. They would view it as more of a confirmation of the greater glory of God, that he has many, many houses, many peoples in the world. They wouldn't put it past him to be able to create other worlds and other peoples. And I also got the feeling that maybe they would be welcoming these people to their congregations so that those alien souls could be saved, and you got alien coins in the collection plate.
I find that hard to believe.
That the religious leaders all said that?
Well, no, I believe they said that to you. I just don't think it's that easy to integrate these experiences into these traditional religious systems. I think they represent a profound challenge to religious systems. And I think that's one of the functions and one of the excitements of literature around the paranormal, in particular UFOs, is that on some level, those books are a profound challenge to people's assumptions about religion and how it works.
Well, I will have to share with you those interviews. It was only three, so it's not like I did a gigantic across the board study or something, but it seemed I chose different faiths, and it was the reaction was all the same. I suppose it's possible that it's a lot easier to say we don't have a problem with it to a reporter in the brightness of day. It's another thing to when you're actually being confronted with
Well,
it.
look, look at the Ezekiel stuff. If we could somehow establish beyond a reasonable doubt that what Ezekiel was really looking at and really was being abducted by was what we call a UFO, boy, that changes the meaning of that biblical book. And I think that I think there is a profound discord there. But there's also a profound connection. In some weird way, the UFO stuff and the paranormal stuff both confirms the reality of what the religions are getting after, but they also challenge how those realities have been interpreted and passed on to us.
Two other books of Vallée's that we have not mentioned, but I could sort of lump them together, and The Invisible College and Forbidden Science. And Forbidden Science, sort of a, there's two volumes of that. I'm reading one of them right now, and it's sort of a memoir, a private memoir based on his journal entries, and it sort of introduces another really interesting theme in this field of ufology, and that people like Jacques, who have an open and honest sense of inquisitiveness about the topic, you almost have to do it under the table. You know, that there is a fear of ridicule. There are consequences for academics like yourself who are open about wanting to pursue these things and write about them. And so you almost have to deal with an invisible college or a, you know, speak to groups off the record and not publish necessarily.
Oh, well, I see that all the time in the academy. Both in my own field, but also among scientists. I mean, I've had I can't count the number of private conversations I've had in hallways and over phones about people who are very basically convinced the stuff is real, but are not willing to write about it or speak about it in public because
And it
it would negatively affect their status in the field and their careers. I mean, I understand that. That's again, I don't think that's something to dismiss. But it's how the social frame controls knowledge, and it's how, as Fort would say, it's precisely how things get damned.
but it hasn't hurt you.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
Well,
I mean, this book just came out. I don't think this book will hurt me at all because I've written so many other things that were taboo as well. I mean, I sort of made a career writing about taboo things like sex and religion. And I honestly believe that the way I've written about this, my sense of it is that a lot of people, at least in my field, will basically say, he's right. We know this stuff's out there. We just don't know what to do with it. And maybe this is a start.
well, I guess the the fact is that if you've written about this before, they already know you're crazy, so why fire you now?
Right. No, they're not going to fire me. That's not going to happen.
Jeff Kripal is my guest. He's the has written a new book called Authors of the Impossible. It's going to be made into a film. We'll talk about that and go to the phones with your questions right after this break on Coast to Coast AM.